Welcome back to the Cyclist Magazine podcast. I'm your host, James Spender, and I'm sadly alone today. Will has jetted off to Japan right now. I'm sure he is knees deep in some ramen or racing around the streets of Tokyo in a little Mario Kart, which is actually a thing, which is kind of cool and looks exceedingly dangerous. Like when you see people on recumbent bikes, but they then become recumbent people. But when you see them riding through traffic and they have to have that little flag so that they don't get run over by people in Land Rovers. But they're fast, aren't they, recumbents? So, you know, maybe you can dodge that bullet. So I'll keep it short and sweet, but I did just want to say, because it would be remiss of me not to remind everybody out there that as well as being a wonderful cycling podcast, we hope you think we're wonderful. We are also an equally wonderful, if not maybe even slightly more wonderful, magazine. A print publication, no less, in this day of digital data. A real paper product. And we've just put our, as they say in the trade, the last one. We've just put the last one to bed, which means it's gone off to the printers and it's running through some big print drums as we speak, and it'll be landing in shops. And it's got a really cool article in it, actually, this month. I say actually, Cyclist has always got great articles in, but this month particularly is a piece about getting back and forth to Belgium, Flanders in particular. Flanders, yes, this time of year, it's very popular to go and ride some of Flanders' most famous bergs. But the hook is in 24 hours. So taking the Eurostar out of Paddington in the morning, getting a bike, going out and riding 80K, riding up the Quarmont, Koppenberg, the Paterberg, even getting a couple of Lefes in and then getting back on the Eurostar and being home. I wouldn't say in time for your tea, but being home by, you know, a reasonable hour where you could basically call it a day and you could still go to work the next day or hang out with your family, whatever it is you choose to do the day after you go cycling when you've just absconded from real life. So I suggest you pick up a copy. It'll be in the shops on Friday, I think. So the day after this podcast comes out. But onto the podcast. We've got a wonderful guest lined up for you today, Mr. Maurice Burton, track legend, trailblazer, first black British national track champion. Maurice grew up in South London in the 1970s, and like most kids, he just rode a bike around the streets, bit of fun, racing his mates. But a school trip to Herne Hill Velodrome in the early 70s saw Maurice start thinking that actually a career in cycling was possible. And by 1973, even though his parents didn't even know he was racing, he had won the junior sprint at the British Track Championships. And the following year, 1974, as I said, he became Britain's first black cycling champion, winning the senior scratch race at the National Champs. And that, as you might expect of the day, soon led to a career in Belgium, because Belgium was the home of track cycling with huge events, particularly the 6 day, still really going strong in the 1970s and 1980s, and making, you know, if you got in on that circuit, you could make really good money. And indeed, Maurice did. And he rode 56 professional 6 day races. But he also had to scrimp and save to get by in his amateur days. And he tells us some brilliant stories about that. But unfortunately, track is a particularly dangerous and, as we'll also come to, real quite backstabby sport. And a horror crash ended Maurice's fortunes, one would say probably quite early in his 30s. But unperturbed, he went back to the UK, cracked on for a long time as a cycle courier and did lots of other jobs as well. But eventually ended up working in and then taking over De Vere Cycles, which is in Streatham in London. And it still is there, still growing strong. You can still find Maurice there on a Saturday. That is, provided he's not in Lanzarote in his holiday home, because he doesn't like, by his own admission, doesn't really like the cold. And most recently, he's been working on a book. It's Maurice's biography. It's called The Maurice Burton Way, which is a brilliant name. He wanted to call it My Way by Frank Sinatra. Of course, that song is, which would have, you know, taken him into various legal disputes, one can be sure. But instead, he plumped for The Maurice Burton Way, which is a nod to the cycle path that is named after him, which is, that's an amazing achievement, isn't it? Having a cycle path named after you. Maurice is also inducted into the Hall of Fame, of course, which is maybe arguably a bigger achievement. I just don't know. We can find out. But The Maurice Burton Way is available, or will be available, it's not quite out yet, on the 28th of March, and it's published by Bloomsbury Books. I was lucky enough to get sent an advance copy and read it cover to cover and loved it. It's a tremendous book, and Phil really gets some great stories out of Morris. But we got some great stories too. So without further ado, can we welcome to the show, or can I, because it is just me, Mr. Morris Burton. So take me back then to, you know, contrast Morris as a 14-year-old just about getting into cycling. I think your school took you to Herne Hill versus Morris. He's been given, you know, you got the straw boater and the tie. That's Morris 2024 at the Pickwick Club. What did you look like on a bike when you were 14? What kind of bike were you riding? What kind of kit were you in? And where were you going when you were meeting up at Blackfriars Bridge with your cousin?
Well, that was when I was 12, when we used to meet up on Blackfriars Bridge. Uh-huh. And because it was, my dad didn't want me to have a bike, because whether he felt it was dangerous at the time, you know, which is nothing compared to now, I guess, but he felt, maybe he thought I was accident prone or something, but he, for whatever reason, he decided that he didn't like the idea of me having a bike. I think my older brother, I've got a brother 10 years older than me. What happened with him was that he borrowed a bike from a friend, smashed the bike up of some way or another, and my dad had to end up paying for it, you see, which might have put him off the idea. But he obviously had something about bike, because after that, my brother was walking down in Peckham in Schumacher Lane with a bike, and he saw my dad and he dropped the bike and he ran. He just left the bike. Yeah. So I don't think my dad was very keen on bikes, put it that way. And so I had to take things into my own hands, as I often do over the period of my life. And I managed to get a bike. In fact, it was a smashed up bike that was in a front garden, you see. And I got the bike and I fixed the bike up. My dad saw it. He said, "What's that?" I said, "Oh, it's just a friend, Dad. Their friend's bike. Don't worry." And anyway, I got this bike when I was 12. And then Dexter, he already had a bike. That's my cousin. He had a bike already, although he's still 2 years younger than me. And he lived in North London. We lived in South London. So we used to meet on Blackfriars Bridge and go off riding. But the thing about it is, at 12, going on then 13, it just was noticeable that there wasn't anyone that I knew that could get the better of me on a bike. So I knew that I had this ability. But at the time, bearing in mind, there was no internet. How do you get to know about a cycling club? How would you know? If you don't have anybody that's involved in a club, how would you know how to join a cycling club? There wasn't no information in those days that I knew about, you know. And so it was only, I knew that at 14 years old that my school had an option. We used to have an afternoon a week to do sports. And at that point, before that age, you could do football, you could do rugby in the winter, and then in the summer you could do athletics or tennis or whatever. But then at that age, then cycling became an option as well. And so I was quite looking forward to that. Before I actually even went down there, it was in my mind all the time that this, where I arrived, where I got to, was always, that was always in my mind. That's what I wanted to do. And it happened to be that I went to Herne Hill with the school, and the first time we went there, we didn't ride on the track that day. We had to go in the grandstand and listen to a talk from a man called Bill Dodds, who started the whole thing down there. He started the VCL club as well. And Bill, I remember the words he said at that point was, "From here, you can go to the Olympic Games," you see, and not necessarily the words, but it meant for me that this is where I needed to be to get to where I wanted to go. you see, and that's what's happened really. And so from that point at Herne Hill, from going down there, it took off from there really. So I started racing at 15. I won the track league at Herne Hill with nearly double the points of the second rider.
Yeah, wow.
So when you were first riding a bike, when you got that bike and you were riding with your cousin, were you immediately wanting to go as fast as you can, race it around, rather than just, you know, going to see parts of London that you wouldn't normally go to?
Yeah, I wanted to be, I used to look, you didn't get a lot of information in those days about professional cyclists, the continental scene. But when Eddy Merckx won the Tour de France in 1969, the first time he won it, they used to bury him. That's a year after I got the bike, 69, yeah. So at that point, you used to see on World of Sport, ITV World of Sport, they showed about 10 minutes every Saturday of the Tour de France. And I saw the picture of I saw it on there, him winning the Tour de France. And I said to my dad, I said, I want to do that. And he said to me, he said, if you want to do that, you need to eat steak every day. So I went to my mum and I said, Mum, from now on, I need you to give me steak every day. Because that was Eddy was always, you know, I looked at him and I thought, that's what I want to do. And that was about 13 years old, maybe. That's what I wanted to do. From then onwards, that's what I focused on.
So you didn't have, was Eddy Merckx your kind of first hero? I mean, I'm thinking around that time growing up, he had, you know, the tragic death of Tom Simpson, Beryl Burton in the 50s, and well, she competed into the 80s.
Well, yeah, I went to the library. I did get a book about Tom Simpson, which Cycling Is My Life, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And so I read the book, and I read about how he'd gone to France and how he'd gone to Europe and all these things and the teams. So that's how I got what information I could about the sport. A little bit later, of course, I knew about Beryl Burton. Yeah. But Simpson, he was one of the people I looked up to. And of course, Reg Harris as well. Reg Harris was who in the 50s, Reg Harris was a household name in the UK. So yeah, these are people that I admired and looked up to.
Yeah. And at what point did you think, or maybe like what results were you getting that made you think, I might actually be a bit like these people one day?
James, I'll tell you the truth. From the first time I raced at Herne Hill, and I won straight away, you know. I had a belief in myself that I could do it from the beginning. There was never... Put it this way, if I thought that I wouldn't have been able to be a professional, I wouldn't have even bothered.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done it. I would have just rode around for fun. I wouldn't have bothered to get involved in racing unless I knew I could go all the way.
Did your parents share that attitude with you?
They wouldn't have known.
Really?
I was a British champion before they even saw me ride a bike.
Are you serious? How is that?
That's
incredible.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
It's not incredible. It's just a matter of fact that...
No, but to hide it from your parents.
Well, I didn't have to hide it. They just see me going off. I mean, things were different. I don't know. When we were younger, say for example, nothing to do with cycling, but say for example, me and my cousin Dexter, who's 2 years younger than me, as I said, when we were about 8 or 9 years old, we'd go down to say on a Sunday sometimes in the summer, our families would go off to the seaside somewhere, probably somewhere like Southend or Jaywick or one of these places. And they'd have this big tarpaulin and they'd put it on the ground and we'd have sandwiches and things and all that. I don't know. And then me and him, we just go off. We just go off to the amusement arcades. And we used to end up coming back with more money than we started with. But we, you know, at 8, 9 years old, we were left to our own devices. We never, you know, there wasn't this sort of situation where where you was monitored all the time, and somebody had to know where you was or what you was doing at any given time. You know, I mean, and especially by the time I reached the age of say 12, 13 years old, I'd just look at them and I'd say, Dad or Mum, I'm going out now, and I'd be gone. And they don't know where I've gone or what I'm doing, and that's it. And as long as I come back, and as long as I don't get into any trouble, or they don't get no police bothering them or anything like that, then that was fine. That's how it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
But what did they say then, having found out? So you come home and you say, by the way, Mum and Dad, I'm now a British junior champ.
When I won the second one, which was the one where they were booing on 74, the 20K, the senior 20K that I won at Leicester, that race was on television, on grandstand. And a friend of mine, actually, I think he called my dad, because the problem is, you see, grandstand is BBC. And my dad used to like watching the wrestling on ITV. There's a fellow, especially this guy called Mick McManus. I don't know if you ever heard of these wrestling. Well, my dad used to like the wrestling. And so the truth is, well, I don't know until he passed away. My dad passed away in 2020. He was 101.
Wow.
But at that point, I don't know that they ever saw the race. I don't know that he did. But I guess, well, after I won the junior sprint, I did get a selection for the Commonwealth Games with the coach at the time, Norman Shiel, said that whoever won that junior sprint would go to the Games, and it happened to be me. And Norman was good for me. Unfortunately, after he didn't actually make it to the Games, he left and went to Canada due to issues with the Federation. So, yeah, that was a shame from my point of view. But I got selection for the Commonwealth Games. So I guess they were, well, put it this way, I remember when I came back from the Commonwealth Games and we landed at probably Heathrow. And then I remember getting the train into Victoria Station, and somebody from the club came and picked me up and took me home, because I don't think that my parents even knew when, I don't know. They just didn't have people didn't have phones we had a phone at the house, but I might have maybe rung or something. Maybe my dad was working or something and he couldn't come and pick me up. So somebody from the club came and picked me up at Victoria when I came back from the Commonwealth Games. You see, so they didn't really have they didn't have no idea of what I was doing or what was going on. Yeah.
Incredible.
Which in a way is good. In a way, you know what? I've seen, and I used to see some of the other riders of my age with their parents with them, pumping their tires up and this and that and stroking them and saying, well, you know, you didn't do too bad and all of this. And some of it, you know what? It's, I don't know. Sometimes some of these youngsters, I think, some of them were more riding for their parents than they were for themselves, you know? I think there is some parents out there, unfortunately, who are trying to live their life through their offspring, you know, which I didn't have that problem.
Yeah, which definitely takes the pressure off. But also, I'm guessing, it makes you kind of, it hardens you up, right? You've got to fend for yourself. You've got to, say, learn how to look after your own
That's
equipment
right.
or how to get yourself to a race. And I think, like, I know we're going to probably jump quite a lot in the timeline, but you soon found yourself in Belgium, but you found yourself alone in Belgium, trying to break it through into, you know, break through into a continental scene, which is something that I think is probably quite Masonic, isn't it? Like, you know, there's a certain type of person that does those races, and they're French, Belgian, possibly Italian, and they're white, and you're coming from England, and there's no history of cycling in England. I bet that was really hard. Could you describe a kind of like typical week and how it worked?
Well, okay. Well, let's let me explain how it first came that I ended up going to Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was that I won that national 20K at Leicester in August, probably, I think it was. And a few months later, I got this telegram letter from Trinidad. And what it was a personal invitation for me to go and ride in February 1975 in this international races that they had in Trinidad and Barbados. And, you know, I mean, it was all expenses paid. The thing is, you see, is that when I went to the Blackpool in December to collect my trophy from the Federation at their, you know, their annual ball or whatever you want to call it, you know, when they give out the trophies. So anyway, I was there and talking to some of the officials, remember I just turned 19 now, yeah? And I'm talking to them and I assumed naively that they knew about this whole thing with Trinidad, because the letter came via the Federation, because these people in Trinidad or Barbados didn't know my home address. So I went to the Federation. So I assumed that they knew, but they didn't know. And they were a little bit taken aback when I told them that I'd got this invitation to ride in Trinidad and Barbados. And so their answer to me was, well, we didn't select you for these events, so you won't be able to wear a Great Britain jersey, which, you know, be honest with you, whatever, even if I had to wear a T-shirt, it wouldn't have made no difference to me, because a few weeks in the sunshine in the West Indies in February, all expenses paid, wasn't something I was going to turn down. Anyway, the point is, that was November. And then I thought to myself, well, there's no racing. There was no indoor tracks in England. There was no racing apart from cyclocross in the winter. So how was I going to get myself in any sort of condition to be able to give a good account of myself in February in the West Indies? This Australian fellow, who was already a pro as such, pro in inverted commas, really, but decided he was going to Belgium to try and break into the six-day races. So I said to him, could I come with you? And he said, yes. Yeah. So I went with this guy to Belgium the first time I went. His name was Peter Verlistock. Anyway, we went over there and we got there Christmas Day. We watched the race, the big race on the track there Christmas Day. And then we went to see some people and because we needed somewhere to stay. And they found us an accommodation in this building. It was owned by a butcher. And I stayed there after that for some time. We called the butcher's shop. And have you heard of a rider, Alan Piper? You heard of that guy?
Yeah, coach Tadej Pogačar, didn't he?
Alan Piper came there when he was 17. And Jan, the butcher's, the guy's name was Jan. Jan Vermeeren. Well, Jan didn't have any more rooms. So what he did, he got newspaper and covered the front window and made it into a room. So Piper lived in the shop window. That's where he lived. I had a little bit better than that. But anyway, we got this place to stay in Belgium. And then the first time I raced on the track in Ghent, in those days, they had races every Saturday for amateurs. They had big meetings and things. There was a lot more going on than there is now. Now it's only the Ghent 6 day. Back then it was a lot more than that. Anyway, the first race I rode was what they used to call here Devil Take the Hindmost. I think they call it elimination now. Yeah. So we're in this race. And what happened is that, you know, the last rider across the line has to come out. So I was getting a bit stuck. So I went underneath, which off the track onto the blue bit round the, yeah. So I went underneath and come back up again. But apparently they didn't like that. So they disqualified me. So the first race I rode, I got disqualified. But the promoter of the track at the time, a man called Oscar Damas. Oscar Damas, the moment he saw me there and he come over to me. And from that point onwards, he liked me. He liked the whole thing about me. And the Ghent 6 has already gone past when we got there. That was December. So there was a big meeting in February, and that was just before I left to go to Trinidad and Barbados. I flew back to London and then drove back to London, and then flew to Trinidad and Barbados for the for the big races that I mentioned. So before that, there was a meeting. It's called the Night of Vedetten, which means the Night of the Stars. So mm-hmm. in the meeting, they had two amateur races. And before that meeting, I went to see Oscar, and Oscar said to me, he said, "I'm going to give you a cadeau," he said. You know, a cadeau is French for present.
Okay, yeah.
So right. he said, "I'm going to give you a cadeau," he said, "because I want you to come back next winter to ride the Ghent 6 day, the amateur 6 day. I want you to come back." So what happened? There was two races. He put all the good riders in one race and put me in the other race. So he knew pretty much that there had no way that I could lose the race. That's what he did. And I've got a picture somewhere of me holding the flowers, riding around the track with the flowers. So that was my first experience in Ghent. The next winter I went back. That time when I went back the next winter, I was on my own. I went there on my own. I managed to get the car. I'll be honest with you, I didn't pass the test or anything. I just got the car. I bought the car from a guy. He was selling the car for £140. He needed a bike, so I sold him a bike for 70 and gave him 70 cash. Took the car and went to Belgium with the car. And I went on my own, but because I'd been there the winter before, there was a few people that knew who I was or something like that. And it went from there, really.
So are you still? When you went back, were you living with Jan at the butcher's shop?
And I went to the butcher's. That was my first port of call. Yeah, so I did spend that winter living in the butcher's shop, and that summer of 76. In the winter, I didn't have a proper bed. I just had a mattress on the floor, actually. But
blimey.
And I wasn't the only one in the butcher's shop. There was other people. There was an American called Roger Young, who's still has contact with me on Facebook. There was a few others.
So was this guy just really into, he just loved cycling? Or were you like paying him rent? Was it like a business for him? I'm intrigued as to kind of like...
Yeah, well, he was a bit of an odd character, that's for sure. I mean, no, but he was. He as far as the only time I ever saw him wash, I did see him wash once, and that was sometime later. I saw him wash because he had this container where he used to put all the newspaper. He used to collect newspaper. He'd go around with a cart and collect and when he filled up the container, I guess they took it away and he got paid some money. Yeah? I think he was a seven-day Adventist or something like that.
Okay.
But it was a religious thing, and he was very odd. He never washed, this guy. He had this beard and he used to eat this porridge and stuff like this out of a bowl that he'd never washed a bowl. He'd just keep eating out of the, you know, he was very, and I saw him, we saw him wash once, and he went and put on a suit. I think he had to go to court because of something happened with the, I don't know, there was some sort of a issue, you know, not major, you know, something to do with a vehicle, and he had to go to court. And I remember seeing him wash and there you could see the lines down his back where the, you know, where the water was like, you know, he used to sleep. You used to see him sleep on this settee. And I don't think he even took his shoes off, you know. He used to just sleep and he'd lay there. But the one thing I would say about the place, it was always warm because the way that he used to heat the place, he used to burn some of the newspapers. And so it was always, you know, in the winter time, we didn't suffer too much with the cold, which is good because I don't like cold. Yeah, that's why I'm here in Lanzarote right now as we speak. Yeah.
I love that. Wow. So at the same time, you know, there's some humor in there, but I bet that must have been hard, like, grifting, grafting way of living in the early days, particularly. I know, like, you obviously went on to be incredibly good at 6 day racing, but in those early days, like, how did you scrape by? How many races did you have to win or sort of help or sell? And, you know, what are you eating? So I bet Jan's not sorting you out with steak.
No. No, I used to go into the butcher, get filet americain, What I'll tell you what happened. What happened was, okay, so I said I went there. I was there the first time in winter in the late 1974, early 1975. So I went back in October 75 to ride in the Ghent 6 Day and other races. So I went back there and I was staying at Jan's place again. And I'd had a bit of a, I won't go into all of that now, but the race that I was defending champion didn't work out too well. I crashed. Somebody's pedal went in my wheel. I crashed. They even disqualified me, even though I didn't finish the race because I didn't reach the finish line. They disqualified me, which I couldn't see how that makes sense. How can you disqualify somebody if they didn't even finish? But they were, it was as if they were kicking me while I was down on the, you know, and I was a bit, you know, you can get a bit down with all these things, you know. I mean, I did come away with something. I came away, we won the team pursuit, British champion team pursuit. I was second in the Madison, but I was a bit down. So I went to Belgium, and maybe I wasn't under my best form when I went to Belgium. So the first race I rode, I think in the first race on the track, I only came fifth in the race. And after the race, I thought about it and I thought, you know what? If I don't pull my finger out here, I'm going to run out of money. And so when I got back, I wrote down everything that the cost, what it cost me to live, because the rent was not much. It was maybe about £5 a month at the time. It wasn't much. So there's the rent. And then I used to think, well, in the morning, I need to have my porridge. I need my porridge, I need some bread, and I need cheese. And I worked out how much it would cost me to eat. I worked it all out. And then I had to work out a plan, was how am I going to get myself in shape so that I can earn money again. So I used to get up every morning, and I'd ride to the border, Zeldzaat, which is the border with Holland. And I had this plan that I did this ride every morning and full gas all the way there, all the way back, come back, take a rest. And in the afternoon, every afternoon on weekdays anyway, you could train on the track in Ghent and there'd be lines of riders, maybe 20, 30 riders riding. And you just get in the line. Anyway, the long and the short of it is I did this for 2 weeks. And then I came back and I won. The next race I rode, I won. And the form was there again. And then the Ghent 6 came. My partner ended up selling the race in the end because we couldn't lose normally. But anyway, we were second. And then Oscar put me and the American, Roger Young, in the Christmas Day race with the pros. I had my first contract to ride with the pros, even though I was still amateur, but it was a contract. We were paid to ride with the pros Christmas Day. That was Christmas Day. 1975 with Merckx and all the guys there riding. Yeah. Wow. So, and yeah, I earned my money. And then I rode with a rider, Paul Medhurst. We rode in Rotterdam. We used to ride in Antwerp and these races. And so, yeah, it wasn't a fortune, but it was enough. It was enough for me to eat. Yeah.
How did your lifestyle change then when you did start making money? What was the contrast like from being, you know, your little butcher shop with your newspaper?
Well, the lifestyle, I'll tell you what the lifestyle was really. The luxury, put it like this, the luxury that I had after I left Jan's place was in the summer of 77, my last year as an amateur, because I raced on the road in Belgium as well, which you needed to ride on the road to have the strength to ride in the 6 day races with the pros. You needed the road strength. And although I never raced on the road much in England because for various reasons. One was that the distance to get to the race for a start. The second thing was they didn't really pay much. I remember riding a race in an amateur race or junior race in England. I came second, I think. It was raining all the whole race. I won a cigarette lighter. And I thought, well, this is not for me. So anyway, but no, in Belgium, that summer, 77, I rode 80 races between May and the end of August. So I went there in good shape. I won the last race I rode I started training after the winter in about March, April. And before I went, I won a race at Crystal Palace, got away, won the race. And then I went to Belgium and started racing. And I rode 80 races. I used to average ride about four or five races a week. But the races would be anywhere between 110, 120, 130 kilometer races. And I didn't have a car. But in Ghent in the summer, in those days, you could ride within an hour's ride from Ghent. You could race nearly every day. And the races cost maybe 20 pence to enter the race, 20 prizes. Yeah. And so if you come in the first 10 or the first five most of the time, then you haven't got a problem. You see, you can eat. And so by the time I turned pro, I'd broken two frames because of the roads. A lot of the roads were cobbles in those days. And the frames that I had just wasn't strong enough for it. They broke. And so I had to buy a new frame. But I had money. I was in profit. I had money in the bank when I turned pro. But going back to the point you said about the difference, well, the difference was living in where I was living, there was it was called the Velotel Tom Simpson, owned by a man called Albert Buick, who was a big supporter of Tom. And I was the only cyclist in there, but there was two other drunk guys that lived in there. And every night they were pissed and they'd go to the loo, which there was only one as far as I remember. And they used to miss the toilet and they'd miss it, and it wasn't very pleasant, you know. And so the biggest luxury I had was when I turned pro and I had my own little house that I rented that I lived in. My luxury was that I had a nice clean toilet that I could use. that was my luxury, actually. That was a great thing for me. But then, riding as a pro, obviously I was able to buy a car. I had a reasonable car. The lifestyle was pretty much similar to what I've got now, really. You know, I enjoy having a reasonable car. With my wife, we go out. We don't eat at home a lot. We go out and we eat most evenings. We eat in the restaurant, you know, and that's, have a glass of wine or a beer or whatever. That's it. I don't need to. I'm not an extravagant. I wouldn't say I'm really extravagant, but I just like to have a nice lifestyle, really.
Increase your power, your cardio efficiency, and your brain function. All are possible according to ketone drink experts Delta G.
Developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the National Institutes of Health and funded by DARPA, Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester is the most potent on the market, allowing riders to enter an otherwise unobtainable metabolic state, ketosis, without carb restriction.
Ketosis is seen when there's low blood sugar, with the body turning fat into ketones instead. Usually, you can only increase ketone levels using a low-carb diet or by fasting, but Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester produces ketosis in the presence of normal blood sugar. It's why Delta G can boost power, because you now have three energy sources for muscles: glucose, fat, and ketones. And Delta G can also boost brain function, because both ketones and glucose fuel our brains.
There are a variety of Delta G ketone drinks to use for different situations, so head over to deltagketones.com to explore the science and use the code CYCLIST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that CYCLIST isn't just a podcast. No, CYCLIST is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest Cyclist magazine subscription offers. So for listeners who might not be familiar with the six-day format, because that's where you kind of found yourself doing most of your kind of like big successful kind of money earning racing, right? I think you did.
Yes.
Did you do 56 six days? in your career, something like that. What does the format look like? But also, what was the scene like? You know, I've heard various stories about how cutthroat it was. It wasn't just racing bikes. It was guys on amphetamines. It was sabotage. It was...
Well, yeah, because, you had the six-day races go back to over 100 years, and they were very big in America 100 years ago. I know that riders back then were on $1,000 a day, you see. It was one of the biggest money-paying sports in the States at the time. And in Europe, when I was riding, the American scene had gone fallen away. But in Europe at that point still, after I stopped, it tailed off. And now you can't make a living now riding six-day races. There isn't enough of them. There's Ghent, maybe there's Rotterdam, Bremen, maybe 3, 4, 6 days. In my time, there was 18 6 days, you see? And we were paid, put it this way, I guess back then I'd walk away from a 6 day with £2,000, and that was 40 years ago. So wow. You work out what that would be in today's money. And that's me. I'm not, yeah. I wasn't Eddie Merckx. So I don't know what kind of contract he got. A good friend of mine who I was eating with last night, his name Roman Herrmann, but he was a promoter as well afterwards of Stuttgart 6 day. And he told me that Eric Zabel, who was riding after us, he was asking for €200,000 for the week.
Wow.
So anyway, it paid quite well. So the fact that it paid quite well means that you're going to get, obviously, you know, riders are going to be interested to ride. The thing is, there was only one manager in our time, a man called Jan Derksen. Derksen was a sprinter in the time of Reg Harris. He was world sprint champion, Dutch man. And after his career, he became the manager. He was the coordinator between the promoter and the riders. And Jan would have maybe 250 riders on his books. And when you first turn pro and you wanted to come, if you turn pro and you've got a world champion's jersey on your back, say like with Tony, when Tony Doyle turned pro, he became world champion straight away. When you got that jersey, a world champion jersey, then the door is open for you to ride any event any 6 day that you want. Yeah, you can. But if you haven't got that, then it means to say you've got to work hard to get through, to get in there. And so Jan used to have this saying. He'd say, keep your bags packed.
Right.
Keep your bags packed. So what that meant was that if you get yourself ready, you've got to keep yourself in shape, even though you haven't got a race to ride. Yeah. You might not have a contract, but if you keep yourself in shape and you keep everything ready, you see, if somebody, say they've made the program for, say, Ghent 6 day, and then 2 days before the 6 day, one of the riders has had maybe he's had a car accident or something's happened and he can't ride, then all of a sudden they need to fill that space. And so then Jan gets on the phone and he might say, well, let's give this guy a go. We'll see how he does, you know, and he rings you up and says, listen, you need to get to Ghent, or you might need to get to Bremen or Copenhagen in 2 days' time. You're riding the 6 day, yeah? And if you make sure that you're in shape and you get in there and you perform well. I mean, it happened to me pretty much in Berlin in 1980. I rode with a guy, Roman, the same guy I was eating with last night, Roman Herrmann. We finished on 3 laps in Berlin in fourth place. On 3 laps, right? Mm-hmm. Jan came to me after the race with 10 contracts. I signed 10 6 days straight there and then. I rose 16 that winter, you see? Wow. And it, matter of fact, it's like if you perform well, the promoters like you, bang, you can come in. But for you to come in, somebody else has to go out. Because on a track like, say, Ghent, they have, 12 teams, I think. 12 teams fit on the track because it's 160 meters. On the bigger tracks like Antwerp, you could have maybe 18 teams, 36 riders. But on Ghent, you've got 24 riders. So if you come in, then one of those riders has got to go out. And once he goes out, he might not be able to come back in again, you see? And then what's going to happen? You know, he's not getting paid anymore. Because you've got sponsors on the road, yeah. But in those races, the 6 days, you get paid by the promoter for the event. After you do the event, you finish the event, you get paid. That's it. See? And then and then of course, if you've got the next one to go to, then that's good. But if you haven't, then what happens then? You see? And so whenever they see a new rider come along, some of the riders who are there, you know, they think, well, yeah, I don't know. You know, if he comes in, what's going to happen to me? You see? And so everyone's watching their back.
So obviously it would be pretty crazy for you, as like idolizing Merckx in a way when you started cycling and then obviously racing against him later on. Are you always thinking like, wow, this is crazy, you know, these big time riders winning the Tour de France, you know, greatest ever, whatever you want to call it. Is it frustrating that the riders that are getting the big money and doing all these road races, like Tour de France, are then coming in and taking the places of the riders who are making most of their money from 6 day?
No, because without the likes, this is the problem now, isn't it? You know, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day because obviously the 6 day thing is pretty much over, you know, apart from Ghent, it's over. But when I look at the cyclocross, I see the likes of Van der Poel, Van Aert. I see those guys riding in the cross. Now, they must be getting paid pretty good money to ride in the cross. So some people are saying, well, that the riders these days are getting paid so much money that they're not interested to ride on the track. I think they would be interested to ride on the track if they got paid the right money to ride on the track. But the thing is, it's a situation where the promoter, I don't think they got the money to pay these guys. See, that's the problem. So they can't, it's a vicious circle, and that's what the problem is these days. But back in those days, they needed the likes of Merckx, De Vlaeminck, Moser. These are names. When we used to go to Milan, we used to go and ride in Milan 6 day before the road season. And all the Italian riders would be riding, you know, the names at the time. And before the race started, the promoter of the 6 day used to have a meeting with us, all of us. And it was always the same thing he'd be saying, which didn't sound bad, because when you'd been riding all winter and the promoter comes and says to you, he wants you to ride, he says, piano, piano, which means take it easy. Mm-hmm. See? Yeah, it's music. It's music to your ears, you know, because... You know, they're going to pay us. They're paying us anyway. We're getting paid very good to ride, but they didn't want us to ride too hard. But mind you, even though we're not riding too hard, let me just put it in perspective. The amateurs who were riding, who did an hour every night, they'd be riding full gas and they were doing 50 Ks in an hour. Yeah. We'd be riding piano when we're doing 55 in the hour. So even though it's still, you still got to have the legs to do it. But there was a Dutch rider, a friend of mine, Herman Pornstein, his name is. He's still my friend now. And Herman was there, and he said to me, he said, you know, it's easy. I can win all the sprint series. Great. I said, Herman, I said, listen, I said, you keep beating those guys and winning all the sprints. I said, they're not going to bring you back here next year. I said, they didn't bring you here to beat the likes of Moser and those things. They brought you here to make them look good. You see, you beat them guys and you're not coming back. That's it. That was it, yeah.
Have you, this is a bit of a left field question, but have you seen that film, The Wrestler, with Mickey Rourke?
No.
So it's about a wrestler who is in a very similar situation, in as much as like he's getting paid to fight, per fight, you know, he's on contract, and he slowly gets older, his body gets like really beaten up and broken down, and he's on more and more painkillers and various drugs and regimes to keep him fighting, but he's slowly slipping down the ranks. And there's a curious parallel, you know, you said your dad really liked wrestling back in the day, with kind of like the circus of 6 day racing, and you've got a promoter and you've got these guys, you've got a big group of guys, and they're all fighting for a small number of places.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, did that encourage people to end up being like that wrestler type character where, you know, they're basically broken and battered, held together with kind of bandages and masking tape, but they still had to race? Because if you didn't race, you didn't get paid.
Well, it never worked that far, because basically when you slid down and you didn't perform anymore, then they'd take you out and find somebody who did.
And that'd
basically
be it.
That's what happens. Yeah, I mean, but then this is, it's only a reflection on society as we know. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, you guys, I don't know what you're, I don't know how it works with you guys, how you get paid or whatever. But I'll tell you this now, if you don't do the job well, then they'll find somebody who does. And then what happens to you? That's it.
Yeah.
That's the way it is. It's a dog-eat-dog world, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, but I'll tell you now, you know, I had to get my mechanic to sleep with the bike, because they, in those days, you know, with the bottom brackets, nowadays you've got these sealed brackets. I don't know what mm-hmm. you guys, you know, you're cyclists, yeah? You know about what I'm talking about, do you?
Yeah.
In those days, you had a bracket with a lock ring on it, yeah?
Yeah.
So you had to adjust the... You had one side which is fixed cup, then the adjustment was from the other side with the lock ring, yeah? Well, what I found out what they'd done to my bike is that they'd taken the crank off, undone the lock ring and tightened the cup as tight as possible and then tightened it up. And, of course, you're riding. Unless you take the crank off and turn it with your finger, you'd never
know that
it'd been tampered with. And this is the fact. This is what happened. This is what happened, you know?
That's incredible. In your autobiography, in the Maurice Burton Way, you mention a story very similar to that about how important soigneurs were, but how, was it a soigneur that you worked with, you think, in one race, effectively doctored what you were drinking in order to make you race faster?
No, it's not what I was eating. He gave me something and I said, is that a vitamin? I asked him what it was. He said, it's a vitamin. Well, within about 2 minutes of him giving me that, I realized it wasn't a vitamin. And I wasn't very happy at all. Yeah, I wasn't happy. And I disposed of his services because of it. Because, you see, on the one hand, yeah, it's one thing to take something, but... it's different if you've done it and you know about it, but it's when somebody else has done it, you know, the decision wasn't made by me. It was made by him.
Yeah.
And he publicized the fact the night before, I think, that my riders are going to fly tomorrow. And then there was Merckx and everyone. I thought, why are they looking at me like that for? You see? And that was what it was. And that's, yeah, but, you know, that was the world we lived in. It's an interesting scenario, the whole thing.
Yeah, I see. So they were, it was in his interests, or a soigneur's interests, to have his riders, you know, flying in inverted commas, because I guess it made him look good, and then it meant that people would employ him.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's right. There were some of these soigneurs that when they, whatever they gave you, they covered it, say like it was a bottle with something, and the name would have been taped up so you don't know what it is. So he's giving you something and you don't know what he's giving you, you see? And he won't tell you, because if he tells you, in his mind, if he tells you what that is, then you don't need him anymore.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah,
but that
absolutely.
Wasn't for me. That wasn't for me. That type of system wasn't for me.
And then one other story I wanted to ask you about, Maurice, was... and it's a painful one, I think, to go through, because it meant for you, it was kind of marked the beginning of the end, but a horrible crash that you experienced in Buenos Aires when you were racing there. What happened there?
What happened was I didn't at the time work it out, but I know that the tires were tampered with to cause them to blow out. Yeah, anyway, that's what happened, and I broke my leg. And when I was in the hospital, I realized it had all come to me what had happened. And that's at that point I decided, you know what, maybe this is time for me to get out of this business now.
Goodness me.
Yeah. You know, so in a way, like you said with the wrestler, you know, I didn't want to wait until I got to the point where I couldn't, you know, I got out of it. I was 28 years old at that point, and I thought, I just decided that, yeah, I went in a different direction then, yeah.
How hard a decision was that? I know, obviously, you just said there's things pushing you, but, you know, you spent your entire life working to be, you know, you're one of the best at this point in time. You got titles to your name and you're racing at a very high standard with the best in the world. And the guys like you as well. Like you said, you know, the promoters know you, they like you. How hard was it to kind of turn away from that?
I always tried, even till now, I try to be very honest with myself. I try not to. It's always been the case, actually, guys. You know, I'm sorry, but I have to go back to when I first went to Belgium. Before I went to Belgium, I left school, and for a year I was an apprentice electrician. And mm-hmm. I had 2 weeks holiday from work, and I'd never raced much in Europe apart from, you know, international races maybe, or not much at that point. And so although I was a British champion twice, junior and once as an amateur, I was under no illusions that winning a British championship didn't mean to say that you was good enough to cut it with those guys over there on the continent. Mm-hmm. And so I had to make a decision whether or not I was going to be an electrician or a bike rider, because you can't be both. I had 2 weeks holiday. And so I went to Belgium to find out whether I was, that was part, I wanted to find out how I was going to come up against those guys. And if it had been that I'd failed, like the other guy that came with me, Peter Verlistog, what happened with him was that he wasn't strong enough to do it. So he came back and he started the bike shop. He learned how to build frames from a frame builder called Ron Cooper, started a bike shop. And the name, his name was Verlistog. And so he called the bike shop De Ver. And 10 years mm-hmm. down the line, after I'd broken my leg and everything else, he'd gone through a couple of divorces and the tax man was looking. This is in Australia, remember. he kept on at me, and in the end, I took the business off his hands. And that's how come the name of the shop is De Ver, because it's his name, not mine. But, you know, he realized that it wasn't going to work, so he had to do something else. Now, at that age, I think you have to be very honest with yourself in life. And if at that point when I was young, I thought, well, you know what, I can do this. But if I couldn't do it, I would have been an electrician, and that's it, and done it as a hobby, you see. And then lying in that hospital bed with a broken leg, knowing the situation, how long is it going to take me to recover from this leg? And after I recover from this leg, to get back up into where I was before, that's a hell of a fight. That's a hell of a struggle. And I'm not getting, I was still only 28 years old, but I wasn't the same as I was at 18 years old. And I thought, you know what? This is time for me to move on. And that's it. You know, you just have to be honest with yourself and just say, like anything, like business ventures, you know, things come along and sometimes you have to look at it and say, well, you know, some people, they don't know when to stop with business. They got one shop, they want two shops, they want 10 shops, they want 20 shops. I only want one shop because, you know what, I don't want to, I love doing what I'm doing. I love my business, but, you got to look at the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is that what kind of stress are you putting yourself under? Why put yourself through all of that? Because you know what, what's it for? You know, all I want is to enjoy myself, enjoy life. That's it.
And what was your, when you look back on it now, what was your like best memory from doing those 6 days and racing in Belgium and around the world?
I guess one of the best memories was, one of the biggest names I rode with was a rider called Rick van Linden, who had won the green jersey in the Tour. And it was the Antwerp 6 day. And he started the race with an Australian rider called Don Allen. But Don had some issues. He had to come out of the race. after about a day. So my partner was a Swiss rider, René Savary. So Van Linden, I think his brother had ridden with me the year before in Ghent, in Antwerp, sorry. And they said, you know, why don't you ride with Burton? He's a good rider. So they'd sent my partner home and put me with Van Linden. And he slipped down the Klassement, which they didn't like the idea of that because he was a local from Antwerp. So he has to be up there. And so there was one race. They used to, you know what the Derny races are, yeah?
Yep.
Well, a lot of those races were just for points. You know, they didn't count for the overall Klassement. But in Antwerp, they did. They did. They counted. If you gained a lap in the Derny race, it was the same as gaining a lap in the Madison. Anyway, so what happened? We needed to get back up there a bit. So I rode in this Derny race. It was just a 20K. 20K it was. And I won the race with over a lap in front of De Wolf and the world motor pace champion, all these people. You know, I did won the race at over 60 kilometers an hour and brought us up on the Klassement with Van Linden. And up till now, Rick Van Linden still thanks me for riding that race with him, that 6 day, which for me is nice, you know, because he was one of the best road riders of all time, Rick Van Linden.
And what's it like for you now, obviously all these years later, to see riders that have come through Herne Hill and VCL to now be riding and competing in Tour de France, Tour of Flanders and things like that? Do you feel like part of your legacy of what you achieved?
Yeah, I mean, some of those riders are actually, those two boys, Leo and Ethan, are customers of mine. They're my customers. Their parents have brought them into our shop from they were youngsters. I got them an agreement to have Colnago. They were supplied with Colnago bikes when they were younger. And they're so those boys, I've had the occasion when I've been out riding on my bike in the country and they've ridden the other way, not together, but at various times. They've seen me riding and coming in the other direction and done a U-turn and come and rode along with me for a while, you know, just to have a little chat with me or to say hello. And that is the sort of respect that they give me, which is very humbling to me, you know, that riders of that are in the team like Ineos could do that. Or there's other riders as well. Fred Wright, you know, his dad is a very good friend of mine that we sponsored him once when he was an amateur in a race. I've got a picture of him riding our jersey. You know, there's people, other riders like Teo. You know, Teo was around, you know, he used to ride with my son. So, yeah, I don't know how they see where they see me. I you would have to ask them. But Leo has bought my book already. He's already bought it on pre-order. Leo Hayter, he's purchased the book. So that's a great thing for me. You know,
absolutely.
It's as much as Eddie Merckx as riding with him. You know, That's where it is.
Brilliant. That tells us all we need to know. And that's a lovely note to end on. Maurice, thank you so much for joining us. Being an absolute gent to give us so much of your time. And I've loved hearing those stories. And anyone that wants to hear more, because there are tons, the Maurice Burton Way is out. Bloomsbury, I think. And it's end of March. Will it be coming out?
End of March. It's available to pre-order on my site as well at the moment, which will be signed personally by me with your name on it.
And I was going to say, if I bring a copy into De Verde in South London, in Streatham, to your bike shop, will you be signing copies there?
I will do. Yes, I would do if I'm there. If I'm not in Sunnier Climes, which is where I am now in Lanzarote.
Fair enough.
I'll be back from May onwards anyway, and I'll be happy to sign copies. But as I said, it can be, if you purchase through our website, through my website, then you will get, it would be signed by me anyway. It would be signed by me. So
brilliant. Maurice, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Maurice Burton, ladies and gentlemen, and also Will Strickson there. He's still alive in the past. Now you can see how we make these things. We sometimes do the introduction and what we call the intro outro. I'm really letting you in behind the scenes here, but since you're stuck with it, why not? We do the intro outro separately sometimes. It just depends. It just depends. Sometimes we've got a lot on. Other times we've got more free time. Other times we want to make sure we can do things that are much more up to date. And we record something a little bit in the past. It's the magic of podcasts, ladies and gentlemen. But nothing, I would suggest, can compare to the magic of books. And that's why, as much as I hoped you really enjoyed our interview, I do really, really encourage you guys to pick up a copy of The Maurice Burton Way, which is published by Bloomsbury and is going to be out on the 28th of March. Because as much as we had a lot to talk about, we could have chatted for even longer. There is so much more in the book, so much more detail, so many other stories. And it's been really brought to life by Paul Jones interviewing Maurice. And so it's kind of got these two brilliant voices in it. You've got Paul putting in a lot of the context of the time and Maurice just telling it like it is, just in an incredibly, I don't know, I just love that way of storytelling. It's very direct. It's very deliberate. And it's just a rich life, isn't it? I talk to someone like Maurice and think, I need to get out more. So maybe that's what I should do. I'm going to get out more. I'm going to bid you all a good morning, a good afternoon, a good evening, depending on where you are, what time of day it is. I shan't let you know what time of day I'm recording this because that would just be too much. But I do hope to see you again through the airwaves in another fortnight's time, where we'll have another wonderful guest on the Cyclist Magazine podcast. Increase your power, your cardio efficiency, and your brain function. All are possible according to ketone drink experts Delta G.
Developed in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the National Institutes of Health and funded by DARPA, Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester is the most potent on the market, allowing riders to enter an otherwise unobtainable metabolic state, ketosis, without carb restriction.
Ketosis is seen when there's low blood sugar, with the body turning fat into ketones instead. Usually, you can only increase ketone levels using a low-carb diet or by fasting, but Delta G says its drinkable ketone ester produces ketosis in the presence of normal blood sugar. It's why Delta G can boost power, because you now have three energy sources for muscles: glucose, fat, and ketones. And Delta G can also boost brain function, because both ketones and glucose fuel our brains.
There are a variety of Delta G ketone drinks to use for different situations. So head over to deltagketones.com to explore the science and use the code CYCLIST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, lovely listeners. I just wanted to tell you that CYCLIST isn't just a podcast. No, CYCLIST is also a beautiful print magazine. It's packed full of all the best rides from around the world, the newest bikes and kit, and loads of in-depth articles featuring guests just like on today's show. So head on over to cyclist.co.uk/subscriptions and check out our latest Cyclist Magazine subscription offers.